The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Taylor Burke, and I am the Donor Relations Coordinator at the Free Library Foundation, and I'm thrilled to welcome you to tonight's author event. Stephanie Land is the author of the bestseller Made, a memoir that was the inspiration for popular and critically acclaimed Netflix series of the same name. I have read and watched both and loved them. Focusing on social and economic justice and parenting under the poverty line, Land's writing has been featured in numerous media outlets, including the New York Times, The Guardian, and The Washington Post. Picking up where Maid left off, Land's new book, Class, follows her journey through college and into her writing career as she addresses the intricacies of the student loan system, financial burdens, and the judgments of her professors and peers. Joining Land on the stage is Erin Haynes, a founding mother and editor-at-large for The 19th, a nonprofit, nonpartisan newsroom covering the intersection of women, politics, and policy, and an MSNBC contributor. Erin is an award-winning political journalist focused on issues of race, gender, and politics, and was previously the Associated Press's national writer on race and ethnicity. We are so pleased to have them with us this evening. Please join me in welcoming Stephanie Land and Erin Haynes to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Good evening, everybody. Good evening, Stephanie.
Hi.
Well, I am really excited to be having this conversation. Really excited about this book. Congratulations to you. Let's just get right into the conversation. We're going to talk here up here for a little while, and then we're going to have some time at the end for questions for you all. So just, keep those in mind as we go along. So let's just get right into it. Stephanie Class, congratulations again.
Thank you.
This book, which builds on, your first book, Made, but then also is actually the story that you originally wanted to tell. It's about a lot of the things that society says that people like you don't deserve. Joy, sex, dreams, yes. Right? Yes. I mean, why as a society have we decided that people struggling with poverty are not deserving of nice things?
Boy, I could talk all night about that. There's a catchphrase called the deserving poor, and what that usually means is a person who is in poverty from no, quote-unquote fault of their own.
Sure.
And so it's like a person who had some type of event happen, that would be covered by insurance. something that they did not possibly make a choice in order to get him in that situation. For me, it was that I chose to be with a person who was abusive, and left him and homeless. And so because I had baby out of wedlock, and all of this stuff, I can list about 10 things that I've heard over the years, but that didn't make me deserving of, I want to say kindness, but I mean, it also is just, I felt like I couldn't really ask people because I very much felt like it was a made my bed and now I have to lay in it. Or that was kind of the feeling that surrounded me a lot of the time, just from the conversations that surrounded me about people who are in poverty. And so, the deserving poor, those are the the Oliver Twist, you know, type of characters, the very, I wish I could say children, but we don't really treat our children that great in this country. So the undeserving poor become the ones who in turn don't deserve anything. And that means anything beyond rice and beans for a diet, you know, like all of the things that you hear, way beyond, you know, cut out the Starbucks and avocado toast. Sure. It's cut out the ice cream, cut out the box brand cereal. You know, like, why are you spending your money on taking your child to a movie, you know, if you're on food stamps? And it's exhausting. It felt like I was constantly being monitored in some way, or watched. I didn't feel like I could sit down and enjoy a Saturday afternoon in my house, because if I have free time, then I should be working in some way. I'm about 10 years. Well, I went off food stamps in the beginning of 2016. And I'm still kind of uncovering things that have really affected me fundamentally, that just pertain to people telling me that you can't have any help to eat or feed yourself or your child if you're not able to prove to us that you're working a certain amount every week.
Yeah. How give us an example of a way in which that lingers for you now.
Well, we were just talking backstage about how I was blocked in writing this book. I couldn't produce words, and I had so much of a self-shaming narrative. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of it was, look at you, you're in this privileged position now. Like, I wrote Maid in low-income housing. I was still a single mom and managed to write a whole book in that situation. And now I had, you know, the husband, I had just bought a home, you know, like all of this. And I had space, you know, and I couldn't write. And I felt like I had lost my value as a human being because I wasn't able to work. And that, that took a while, like, for me to work through. And I realized it was because for so long, my value to society was how much I was able to work, because I had to constantly prove that I was working. And that was how I ate. Yeah. And you know, when you withhold food from someone because they're not working enough, like, that really, I don't think I'm ever going to get past feeling like I had lost all of my dignity as a human being because I wasn't able to put in the hours.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it seemed like we had a moment, this moment that we have just come through, maybe still are coming through, the pandemic, that really exposed a lot of the vast inequality that was already here in our country, obviously. But I wonder how you think about that moment, how you think about class differently than you were when you were living through this story, and then when you decided to tell this story. How has the pandemic really shaped your relationship to class?
Well, I mentioned that I purchased a house. I took out a giant loan.
Sure. You are purchasing. Yes.
I signed a dotted line that says I can live in this house. I really struggled with that. I actually said to my therapist one day that I was turning into a person that I used to hate. Because it's by East Coast standards, it's a pretty big place, but like West Coast, it's small. it's nice. I mean, it's a place that I would have cleaned, and for money, and that was hard. I felt like I had bounced up to this level of society and this class that was no longer my community. Mm-hmm. And because I had always been service industry, I had always had two or three jobs, you know, my family was middle class because you used to be able to be in the middle class and live in the suburbs. But it was, you know, blue collar worker type of family. And it just felt so weird to have this space and have this home. I felt like it made me kind of soft. Mm. I really struggled with it for a long time. In writing the book, I felt like I had kind of lost touch with the part of me and who I was during that time. Another reference to my therapist, and she helped me.
Shout out to therapy.
Yes. I kept saying, like, I need to get the badass back. Like, I need to be a badass again.
Yes.
Like, how am I going to do this? How can I get in touch with this person who I used to be? And it was difficult that way until I started writing it and got very mad and very angry that I had a new sense of normalcy and a new sense of privilege, really.
Yeah.
And to write about this time period when I was struggling so hard and all of these systems were failing me, I got angry, and it was kind of great.
Right, but also not allowed because you are a woman after all.
Yes. Yeah.
So, yes. I also just wonder what you feel like. What do you feel like we have learned as a country, and what do you feel like we have forgotten as a country since the pandemic about poverty and about inequality? Because I feel like clearly we were able to make certain choices in the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
People were essential workers once upon a time
mm-hmm.
in the pandemic. It feels like we're a long way away from that already.
Yeah, I've been talking to audiences and to people and writing about poverty for quite a while. 2014, it's been 9 years. I actually felt hope at the beginning of the pandemic.
Hmm.
Like Biden tweeted, like, wow, I didn't realize that people don't have paid sick days. And it was just all along. Like, the news was people who could not go to work in the restaurant industry and could not pay their rent.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a topic.
Yes.
And it had never been that way before. And, you know, the essential workers it was nice. But it was, to me, kind of sprinkling glitter on this fact that people didn't have a choice of whether or not they could go to work.
Mm.
And to me, I thought about all of the kids who were being left alone at home, you know, mm-hmm. and who couldn't afford to have the homeschooling pods and didn't have resources for that. And like the grocery store workers and the people that do the jobs that we often feel entitled to,
yeah.
you know, the serving us food and cleaning up after us and the domestic workers and it was a nice feeling, you know, to see that work visible now and recognized but it turned so quickly and it was just suddenly, you know, forgotten again.
Yeah.
And the boosts, you know, everybody celebrated millions of children being lifted out of poverty because of the child tax credit, and the unemployment benefits helped a lot of single mothers go back to school. And, you know, you kept hearing all these really positive things, and then suddenly it's like, oh, well, we're done with that now. And you guys are just all going to go back into poverty.
Yeah. The student loan debt moratorium.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you talked about being a single mother. You're now married. But you are still a mom who has gotten to see poverty through the eyes of your children. What can you say about what you learned about what they understand about poverty?
Wow, no one has asked me that before.
I try.
thank you. That's an amazing question. Coraline, my youngest, she didn't really experience that. She was a baby, and then I got a book deal on her second birthday, and so she grew up. Even Story, she's now 16, my teenager. She has said to me before, well, Coraline had a different life than me growing up. And I see that a lot, you know, between, of course, like Story is like copy paste of me in personality in a lot of ways. And so she's kind of a more broody type. But like Coraline is just this like sunshiny, positive, like sunny side always, like, and Story, I think there's some animosity between the two of them because of that. I don't think Story would ever admit to that, but she told me recently that she remembers kids making fun of her for her clothes, that she remembers going to birthday parties and just kind of like being amazed by other people's homes and the food that they're serving and she's also a very she keeps things to herself and likes to drop bombs every once in a while and just
16 did you say?
So she, as I was telling her about this book and, you know, that I was going to write about what she went through in kindergarten, she told me more memories that she had from that time. And just, and she said, yeah, my teacher held me down on the table, on the desk, with her arm on my back to dig through my pockets. And I was like, well, I thought she grabbed the waist of your pants and went through the pockets. And she said, no, she put me down on the desk and had her arm on my back. And it's just like, I don't know what I would have done if I had known, but at the same time, it would have been nice to have been informed of, you know, not just like from the school, I mean, because the school was informing me of other things constantly, of her behavior, but like, I don't know, just as a mother, your heart breaks.
Absolutely.
when they tell you something that happened 15 years, 10 years ago.
Were you surprised, you know, as you were going through this book and she's kind of sharing these memories with you about how much she did remember?
Not really. She read my first book, Made, and her memory was pretty spotty. I mean, she was three,
sure.
Four. She remembers the cat that I didn't include in the book. She's very
the erasure.
Upset. Like, I can't believe you didn't put Bob. And the
Bobby erasure.
But this book, she really did remember a lot of it. And so I didn't necessarily like interview her, but like I wanted to feel out things that she might not want me to include, pretty much. Because I would never want to write something that would deeply embarrass her.
Yes.
So So we had a lot of conversations, and it was kind of surprising how much she remembers. Although maybe not, because like I said, she's copy-paste, and I remember everything about kindergarten, and so maybe it's not unusual. But I think it was, like I said, heartbreaking, but also just weird that she would pick up on being made fun of for just for how she looked so much.
Yeah. Well, you often say that you are not a journalist, although I don't know. Nor is that, you say that's not your approach to writing. But today I'm waving a magic wand. You are now in charge of the news. How should the media cover poverty better? And what would you say is one thing, the main thing that we get wrong that we should stop doing right now?
Oh, goodness.
I know, just one, I know.
They don't say the word poverty. They don't say homeless people. I mean, they will say people experiencing homelessness. Mm-hmm. And it's there is no starkness. And if it is, it's in a poverty porn type of way. It is, let's find the most palatable poor person. You know, I am one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And let's...
Deserving poor.
Deserving, like, it's... I speak for a lot of nonprofits, and they'll put up a video, you know, before I come on stage to speak. And if it's a single mom, she's a recovering drug addict. She's, you know, going to school and like working her way through, and usually white and adorable children. And it's just this copy paste type of person. And but that's not reality. I mean, the people in poverty are the people that you're sitting next to in school and the people that you're standing next to on the street. And it's, but when people think of poverty, they think of the homeless person who is sleeping on the street, when that is just a visual of the bigger problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that, I mean, pre-pandemic, people were $400 away from losing their home. And then the pandemic began. It was just like we watched that happen. And so for the news, you know, I appreciate it when people mention that states will take block grants that are meant for TANF. And I just saw a very little blip of a news story that Mississippi spent a block grant for TANF on speaking fees for Brett Favre.
Yeah.
And it's just like, could we expand on this? Could we sit with this for a minute? Like, because it's so much energy toward the person in the grocery store line taking advantage by buying cookies. And then states are squirreling away hundreds of thousands of dollars.
To help him, yeah.
To do, I don't even know what. I don't even think he spoke.
Right.
It was just me.
No, there was a lot wrong with that program. Yeah, some really good reporting on that exposed the corruption in that state around that issue. Well, I mean, you brought up the white womanness of it all, so let's get into it. Because we were talking back there about how you do get to pass, right, for certain people who do not make assumptions about who you are and what you've been through based on how you look.
Mm-hmm.
And they will share things with you because they think it's okay because they don't know your story. They don't know your past. What is that experience like for you? Can you give the audience even like an example of how that comes up and what your response is when that happens?
Well, I was telling her just recently for public speaking, you know, I arrive to a venue in a car with a driver, like that's not an
wow.
Uber,
yeah,
a car service, and I think it's maybe because the driver assumes that I have a lot of money, or I don't know, but when I tell them that I'm a writer, and then they ask what I write about, and I usually say like poverty or homelessness, and this driver went into this story about his friend who was down on his luck and used all of his food stamps to buy beer. And it's just and I hear that so much, like, not necessarily people tattling on people or people sharing concern. It's more of just it's disgust. Mm-hmm. And it is, I think there's a lot of hard feelings between the low end of the scale of the working class, the people who are just over ability to apply for food stamps, and the people who are just below it, because that's hundreds of dollars difference in funds that you could possibly receive for food and childcare and medical expenses. And like, I have not qualified for things because I made $100 a month too much. And so I get it, but pitting each other against ourselves is not the answer, you know, but it's just the most visible form of government assistance is food stamps. And I used to have a Facebook friend who was a cashier, and she thought it was funny to report the things that people bought on food stamps. I still see that sometimes, just on Twitter. And I comment online now and say, you know, this is the reason that I was so ashamed. Like, this is the reason that I was scared to purchase Christmas candy, you know, and for other people to see that, because I didn't want to perpetuate this stigma that yeah. people think. And
they were wanting you to join in the finger pointing and the shaming, and you say no. Like, I'm actually going to be in community with these folks and shame you for calling these people out.
Yeah. I do that now in the situation with the driver. It's just kind of like, yeah.
Need to get to my destination also. Yeah. Yes, understand.
Let's say our goodbyes.
Well, look, exactly. Well, look, you mentioned a driver, but like, hello, please read this. This is not a Cinderella story. Cinderella does not have student loans. So, I mean, you have had success as a writer, but it has not made you a wealthy person. I mean, I hear you even talking about that now. Like, what is your reality now in terms of class? What's your relationship now to class, and how do things like debt kind of contribute to your mobility in our society? Even as you've achieved this goal of becoming a writer, you went back to school, but yeah, that doesn't mean that you're, I mean, your circumstances are certainly different. You certainly have a certain level of privilege now, but it is not a fairy tale. This is not a happy ending type story, and nor was made.
Right. I had the biggest type of success that any writer I've known can have in the fall of 2020. And, you know, and it was just having an amount of money that to me seemed it didn't seem real. It was so uncomfortable that, like, I just kept buying friends' presents. I kept, like, my one friend was going through breast cancer, and I kept sending her Jenny's ice cream.
Yes.
I'm sure she kind of hates me.
Or Jenny's ice cream.
Yeah. And I kept donating. I kept, like, I couldn't give it away enough. And I don't know if it's survivor's guilt or just... this feeling of like, I don't know what to do with this, and nobody is here to help me with it. Like, you know, you can talk to a financial advisor or whatever, but like, they don't really speak your language at all.
And they're also talking to you about wealth, not about what you're talking about. Yeah.
Right. Like, I can't say like, well, I have a pretty traumatic experience with money for most of my life. Like, I really don't know what to do with this. And so it has been difficult to keep it to myself because I end up donating to the point where I over donate. And so now it's like I have to kind of force myself to be realistic. Like, every paycheck, like 70% of the money is going to go to other people in some way, either, you know, commissions, taxes, employees. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's still not a job that I can budget for. And it's still not a job that offers benefits. It's really hard for me to get up and speak, and I'm talking about this time in my life when I couldn't have a sick day, and I'm like actively coughing and sneezing, and like, and I'm still in that position where it's, I'm paid better, and I have a much higher level of, I guess, respect with my job, but it's still something that I cannot say no to. Like, I don't turn work down. I work myself to the emergency room. I actually worked myself to the emergency room in Philadelphia in 2022.
Wow.
So I think, you know, there's just this feeling of I never know if this is going to last. I don't think I can trust it. I don't really know what's happening. You know, it's just this like really bewildering feeling. And so I don't know anyone who has like a really healthy relationship with finances, or I guess people don't really talk about it either.
Yes.
But yeah, I'm still somewhat desperately trying to reach a level of security. Not just with my job, but, you know, financially and otherwise. And I don't know what that's going to take just to feel even housing secure. Because yes, once things drop out from underneath you and it takes you 10 years to get it back, it's that feeling doesn't leave, you know?
Yeah. No. Yeah, it's over your shoulder all the time. Well, you are in Philadelphia, which, again, this year has the unfortunate distinction of being the poorest big city in America. And I want to ask you, for Philadelphians who may buy or read this book, what is your message to them? And then for Philadelphians who are or were experiencing poverty, or who were where you were in MAID or in class, what is it that you want them to know?
Well, I think... I'm making an assumption here, but if you can afford to purchase a hardcover book, I couldn't afford that when I was in this place. So I would just hope that my story creates a feeling of empathy and grows to compassion. My favorite people to hear from are the ones who say, I leave much bigger tips now. I am an elementary school teacher, and I see the kids in my classroom differently. One lady just on Twitter, commented that she's going to start putting on her syllabus that children are always welcome in her classroom in college. And it's just like these little changes of compassion, really. And so I would hope, you know, I've always set out to break down the stigmas that surround especially poor single moms, because mothers in general have such a bad, hard time in this country. And then, you know, you take a poor single mom and it's horrible. But for the people, you know, I love it when libraries have multiple copies of my book. I love it when I see free copies of my book in little libraries, and because it makes it accessible. We write so that we don't feel alone, and that was why I wrote it, because there was a time in my life that I was desperately alone and isolated, and I needed a story that I could see myself in. It would have meant a lot to me to know that there was at least one other person out there who was experiencing the same things that I was going through, and so that was not only a big motivator for me, that's always been the biggest hope for me with everything that I write.
Okay, well, with that, let's open it up to people who have questions. There's somebody that'll come over with a mic. If anybody has a question, just raise your hand and we will come to you. Questions?
Hi, I was just wondering, did you always want to be a writer?
Since I was 10, yeah. My fourth grade teacher, who texted me today.
Amazing.
He went to some conference over the summer, and it was like forcing elementary school kids to write. and so the whole year, we wrote short stories. You know, every birthday we had to write a story about whoseever birthday it was. And when we reconnected after the series came out, because I mentioned him in the acknowledgments for Maid, and someone finally told him, like, is this you? I said, why did you do that? And, you know, he told me and how amazing it was just to watch kids blossom. And he said, like, I started to see that you not only needed it, it's who you were. That was just, I watched you grow into yourself. And so I've just kind of known that I was a writer since then. Writers are a weird bunch. I kind of figured like I would grow old. And at that time, of course, was much younger than I am now. And settle down and become a writer. So, which I guess I kind of did.
Yeah.
I didn't publish my first book until I was 40. So I guess I followed on that. That was old for me.
Hi.
Hi.
So as a teacher at both Temple University and the Community College of Philadelphia, Stephanie, I'm wondering if you would give any advice to the college professors out there who would be lucky enough to have a student like you in their class.
I'm gonna say some statistics that I got from you. this is Sarah Goldwick Rabb. So I was just doing an online interview and answering this question. I think the more you can imagine the kids in your classroom in a way that is realistic. If you start to think in just numbers, and I don't usually talk statistics, but I found out recently from a paper that you did that there's a 23% of undergrads are hungry, and 1 in 10 are parents, 1 in 5 are single parents, and 8% of undergrads are homeless or extremely housing insecure. And I think, you know, colleges still picture the student in their classroom as someone who just walked in from the dorm and who doesn't have to work, who might have all of their expenses covered. So I really encourage people to consider, like, well, what if half of my class has a full-time job? What could I do for them? Like, what could I do for people who cannot afford this $200 book about math that is likely not even for their actual degree, and it's just a core class that they're kind of forced to take? What if I used last year's version and we had some kind of lending library? What if I encouraged people to mentor incoming freshmen and just walk them around campus and show them around? You know, what if I brought up the need for a food pantry or clothing pantry or daycare exchange, mm-hmm. or childcare exchange? And I think people really do want to help, but they think about the really big stuff first, and then it gets really overwhelming and nobody does anything. But, I mean, just tiny little things are what keep people out of the classroom or is the reason why people stop going. For first-gen students, it's sometimes a winter coat. They can't afford to have a winter coat, and so they go back home because they're too embarrassed. And it's just the smallest things, and the smallest things that can mean a lot to someone and create a more successful, supportive environment for them.
You talked a little bit about how the trauma and the imposition of society's norms on you when you were in poverty, how difficult it was to overcome that even when you were able to make money from your writing. So, and how you've maybe carried some of that, you know, trauma forward. And even though in society they, you know, they tell us all about, you know, upward mobility and we're such, you know, classless society and, you know, you can do anything in this country if you, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and all those things, you're suggesting that it's not really, you know, that way. So my question is, what are you doing or what can you do or what can other people do to avoid passing that on to their children? Even because I know, you know, your older daughter has now passed from one situation to another.
Story, I don't really talk about what my kids have gone through as they've grown, but Story for a while really struggled with food. You know, I could not afford to experiment. You know, I couldn't just buy broccoli and kale just because I needed to introduce it two or three times or however many it is. I couldn't afford to waste food. And for a long time, she was scared to try things because she was scared that she might not like it. And I still see that. I mean, you know, she's a teenager now, and so she's surrounded by the bullshit of TikTok and, you know, like, what I eat in a day, hashtags. But, like, I still see, like, some struggle with just, like, eating just for the sake of eating or enjoying things or really being in the moment with food. And I might be projecting some things onto her, but it's one thing that I've really watched. And you know, Story has also had an amazing therapist for years, and I've always had that available to her if and when I could afford it. But I also had just other adults in her life that she could talk to. A lot of that was because I was estranged from my family, and she didn't have aunts and uncles and grandparents and stuff. So I enrolled her in the Big Brothers Big Sister program. I made sure that there were people other than me who were showing up for her. Not only because I knew that there were things that she couldn't talk to with me, but there are just other perspectives that she needed. And so as much as I could, I wanted her to feel supported by her community. And that was a lot of, you know, my feeling of being isolated and not having that myself. I really wanted that for her. And so I don't know, you know, I think the term trauma-informed is becoming more and more mainstream. The pandemic did bring out a lot of openness about mental illness and anxiety and depression, and I think, you know, the more that we talk about it, then the less we'll feel ashamed about it. So that, you know, is something that you can do for any generation and children that are not living in your home. So breaking down generational trauma is not necessarily something that is on the parent all the time. So I definitely brought in help with that.
Hi. As the daughter of a poor single mom and a mom myself, I understand that there's a lot of daily struggles that you have to go through. And I'm curious what your thought process is, or how you give yourself permission to get through your daily struggles, but also to have a creative life and to make art at the same time.
When I had eventually written enough words and got paid enough by them when I was freelancing. I had a low-income housing apartment, which to say this number now is just insane, but it was $430 a month for a two-bedroom, you know, 600 square foot, and it wasn't based on my income. Like, it was just, that's how much it was going to be. And so I was able to write. And when I could first afford daycare, like just 3 days a week, there's so much of writing that is just thinking and administrative work. And I had such a hard time with feeling like I wasn't actually working. I still kind of struggle with that. Like, I'm reading somebody else's book that, you know, it's part of my job, but it still feels, you know, extravagant in some way. So, like, just sit and read a book. But it's part of being a writer. And so, you know, as far as finding time, I would give myself 10 minutes, you know, and I kept an online blog for a long time. I wrote constantly growing up. I had, you know, the journals that I don't want anybody to read until I'm not alive anymore. And but that was how I learned and how I found my voice, and then I discovered freelance writing, and a lot of that is getting your personal experience into places that normally people wouldn't see that experience. And I feel so passionate about teaching people to write a good op-ed and get their experience out into the world. The first person narrative is vital, because that's the only way that we'll get to know each other and learn how to listen. So that was my, you know, every time the kid was in the bath, I was at the computer writing. I got very, very good at writing very fast. So I would just kind of keep a notebook and write down sentences as they came to me. And then once both of the kids were asleep, one of them was asleep in my lap, I would get it all down. I'd make a huge cup of coffee, and I'd have this tiny little jar of wine if I had the money for it, and would bust out 3 essays, and that was my life as a freelancer. So, but a lot of it felt like, you know, since I wasn't doing any kind of manual labor, it felt weird to do this thing that, like, is just so wild that you can get paid for it. It took a long time to get used to that.
Yeah. I wonder if you have any ideas how to eliminate poverty in this country?
Eliminating it?
Yeah.
We're going to end poverty tonight. Let's go.
So let's go. I mean, give poor people money. Universal basic income. Abolish work requirements and trust poor people with money. I budgeted so much better when I didn't have any money. Yes. Than I do now. I knew exactly how much money I had all the time.
Every minute.
Every time I went into the grocery store, every time I filled up my gas tank. I have no idea why we don't trust people with money. Like, if I'm going to give my friend $20, I don't ask them for an itemized list of what they spent it on. But that was what I was expected to do in order to live in transitional housing. And so I think that is the core. You know, it's not just the deserving poor and the poor people can't have nice things. You know, that's all part of it. But it's trust. We just don't trust people, poor people with money. And time and time again, when they do universal basic income experiments, they spend it on rent and clothes, and they come out with better mental health. They come out with jobs. They come out sometimes even like contributing members of society because they had this money that they could budget for. And so poor people need security and they need fucking money. You know? So, I mean, pay them more and tip them. And just like, the most generous people I know are the people who don't have anything. Mm-hmm. And I think that says a lot about this country in general. So I guess I'll leave it with that.
Yeah. Thank you, Stephanie. Thank you so much, Stephanie. The book is class. Stephanie Land, thank you for your light, and thank you so much for your story.
Thank you. Your questions are so good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.